Many, many scientists live in real fear of getting on the wrong side of the nutritional status quo bullying. It's academic bullying, and I'm not the only person by a long shot to have suffered it.
Science journalist Nina Teicholz.
When Eisenhower had his heart attack, the entire nation was focused on the question, what caused heart disease? Dr. Ansel Keys explains, it's saturated fat and cholesterol. He swayed that committee to publish advice to the American public, telling them to cut back on saturated fat and dietary cholesterol as the first measure of prevention against heart attacks. There were just numerous flaws. Scientists said, we need to get some better data on Ansel Keys' hypothesis. Trials were done on some 76,000 people, and every single one of those trials concluded that saturated fat and cholesterol have no effect on cardiovascular mortality or total mortality. What happened to the results of those clinical trials? They were basically ignored. For women, when they lower their fat content, their risk of heart disease goes up for everyone, but it goes up for women even more.
What's your opinion on weight loss drugs?
Unsurprisingly, I'm not a fan because I know the scientific literature that it is completely possible to reverse diet-related diseases with diet alone. I feel incredibly sad that most people are not getting good information, including probably even Oprah.
Hey there, welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. If you're new around here, I like to talk health, well-being and self-improvement with many of the world's leading experts every Monday and Thursday. We're almost at 400 episodes now, recorded over the last 4 years. So if you haven't already, please dip into the archive and check out some of those amazing discussions and great interviews. If you're already familiar with the work that I'm doing here and would like to show me a little bit of support, it's absolutely free. You can like, subscribe, share with other people. You can WhatsApp them. You can email them. Tell them about this podcast. They might find some value in it. Also, if you're on YouTube, you can leave a comment. Subscribe over there too. And you can leave the podcast a positive rating on iTunes and on Spotify. We're about 4.8 out of 5 now, which is absolutely fantastic. Now, this podcast is about sharing information, quality information, about how to become better versions of ourselves physically and mentally. For information about our physical health, historically, we have generally relied on scientists, nutritionists, medics, experts, and government regulations. But what happens when that information is tainted? Well, this is what we explore today as I talk with investigative science journalist and author of The Big Fat Surprise, Nina Teicholz. Now, Nina is a force of nature who has almost single-handedly challenged the narrative on fat in our diets and that saturated fat causes heart disease. In this episode, we discover where the commonly accepted and yet disproven idea that saturated fat is bad for us came from. We hear about a physiologist called Ansel Keys and the role his flawed science, his biases, and his sheer force of personality played in influencing the American Heart Association and its dietary guidelines, and how that influence continues to this very day, 70 years on. We hear why researchers were afraid to talk with Nina when she was writing her book. Expect to learn Nina's thoughts on vegetable oils, inclusion in modern diets in recent decades, and how their increased consumption has led to worsening health. We talk about the enormous control large multinational food companies have over our Western diets at the expense of our health. We learn why the pharmaceutical industry thrives off drugs that people take indefinitely, such as the new weight loss drug Ozempic, which Oprah recently announced she's taking. Indeed, I ask Nina what her thoughts are on Oprah's relationship with Ozempic, given her decades-long status as a weight loss icon. My conversation with Nina Teicholz is a real eye-opener with more than a few jaw-dropping admissions. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And let me start by saying I love the name of the book, The Big Fat Surprise. It's super catchy up there on the shelf. And at the start of the book, though, you mention a story about a guy called Stephenson. I won't even try to pronounce his first name, but he chose to live with the Inuit people in the Canadian Arctic. Can you, just to help us put this story into context, could you explain to me again what his story was?
Yes. Vilhelmur Stefansson was a Harvard-trained anthropologist who I think in the 1920s, he went up to the Canadian Arctic, and he spent more than a year living with the Inuit. He lived with them. He ate their food. At first, he was sort of disgusted by what they ate, which was purely animal foods, right? They were eating seals and whales, and they were melting the blubber and drinking that straight. Their diet was, I think, about 70% fat. And Stefansson was completely shocked by this. And he recorded that he found them to be in perfect health, right? These were people who half the year they weren't getting almost any sunlight. And yet they did not seem to have the diseases that were then becoming more common in the Western world, including heart disease. He writes a series of books. People do not believe him that humans could live without vegetables or any kind of grains, or that they could live on meat alone. So Stefansson and a colleague checked themselves into a New York City hospital, and for a year, they follow a diet of only meat and water. So meat, fat, and water. I think only about a few months did they actually stay in the hospital, and then they were monitored by a team of physicians outside of the hospital. It was covered in the media, and people were appalled and thought these two men were killing themselves, a crazy diet that they were on, something like the way that carnivores are received today by the popular media. Yet, at the end of the year, they were shown to be in perfect health in a series of six papers that were published by this team of doctors who had been following them. And Stefansson wrote that he felt great during the entire experiment, and the only time that he started to feel ill in any way was when he thought he wasn't eating enough fat, and he fried up some brains, as he said, in fat and ate them and felt immediately better. It's important to note they ate the whole animal. They ate all the organ meats. They did not just eat the muscle meat. And in fact, the Inuit prioritized the organ meat and often would feed the muscle meat, you know, what we consider, you know, the steaks, the most valuable part of the animal. They would feed that to the dogs. Stefansson tried to convince his colleagues that this was not a crazy idea. He even wrote Ansel Keys, who was the most famous scientist of the day, a letter or a couple of letters saying, you might consider this idea, because at that time, Dr. Keys was promoting the idea that saturated fats caused heart disease, and he did throughout his life. But Stefansson was really met with a brick wall of resistance against what he had documented, and his ideas were never accepted. And in fact, he was vilified by Dr. Keys in a series of articles.
We'll come to Ansel Keys because his shadow looms large over this subject, particularly at the start of this story. Let's go back. You were talking about Stefansson there. That goes back almost 100 years. But I've heard you say elsewhere that there was no heart disease, certainly in North America and the Western world, until the 1950s, when President Eisenhower had a heart attack and everybody was stumped and they couldn't understand what was going on because there was a vacuum of information at the time. So bringing Ansel Keys back into that story again, back in the 50s then, where did the argument that saturated fat caused heart attacks come from? Was it just Ansel Keys, or was that the growing consensus then at the time?
Just one small tweak on what you just said. Heart disease was rare, but not non-existent in the early 1900s in the U.S. and the U.K. It started to become more common in the 1920s and 30s. By the 1950s, it was the number one killer in America. 1955 is when President Eisenhower had his heart attack out of the Oval Office, his official residence, for 10 days. The entire nation was focused on the question, what caused heart disease? Dr. Ansel Keys steps into that vacuum and explains it's saturated fat and cholesterol. There were other competing theories at the time, but Dr. Keys was very persuasive. He was an aggressive promoter of his own ideas. Other scientists at the time were dubious, but Ansel Keys, because of his aggressive personality, was able to maneuver himself onto the Nutrition Committee of the American Heart Association, the premier group for dealing with heart disease then and now. And he swayed that committee in 1 year's time and convinced it to publish advice to the American public, telling them to cut back on saturated fat and dietary cholesterol as the first measure of prevention against heart attacks. So that's the first advice in 1961, anywhere in the world, telling the public to avoid saturated fat and cholesterol. Ansel Keys did have some colleagues, and he did have some data. But throughout the 1960s and 70s, as I explain in a lot of detail in my book, there were many, many critics of his ideas. There were top critics at major universities who published critiques of Ansel Keys' hypothesis. And my book just goes into a lot of detail about how those critics were harassed, the bullying actually that took place in trying to get competing ideas out of nutrition. It's ultimately a very political story of how Ansel Keys and his hypothesis triumphed and became the nutritional dogma that we still live with today.
So it was very much, for Ansel Keys, it was a case of him imposing his personality and his philosophy on other people at the time. And really, I suppose the question is, what was the research performed on his behalf to underscore his philosophy, his hypothesis at the time? What was the scientific basis for him believing that dietary fat caused heart disease back as early as the early 1960s?
When that 1961 official advice from the American Heart Association came out, Ansel Keys had performed some small, tiny studies on humans, some animal experiments. There was really no major data to support that. He depended upon a study he was conducting called the Seven Country Study, still unpublished, not published until 1970. But it was still the biggest undertaking that anybody had ever seen on nearly 13,000 men, only men, in the U.S., Japan, and a number of countries in Europe. And Ansel Keys and his team, he took the cholesterol, the serum blood cholesterol of these men, and he tried to analyze what they were eating through dietary surveys and through analyzing the food. And so this seven-country study was a very dominant study in the field. It was published in multiple issues by the American Heart Association. It came to be like the big bang of nutrition science. It's cited already a million times by 2006, I believe. So it was hugely influential. And what did Ansel Keys find? Well, he already believed, and the American Heart Association had already published, that saturated fat causes heart disease. So that is what it found. It found that in countries, it was in locations like Crete, people ate very little saturated fat and seemed to and toiled in the fields all day long. These are the star subjects of his study, and died at lower rates of heart disease than, say, the Norwegians. Sorry, not the Norwegians. In Finland, I think it was the loggers who were gorging on sausage and butter and seemed to die at much higher rates of heart disease. For my book, because this study is so important, I took a huge deep dive into the study, and I think documented more than really anybody else ever has. There were just numerous flaws. For one, Ansel Keys, it's fair to say he cherry-picked his countries. He chose places like Italy, Greece, Yugoslavia, devastated by World War II, disrupted food supplies, mass emigration, where they were eating very little saturated fats, low rates of heart disease. And he ignored countries like You know, the omelet-eating French, the sausage-eating German, West Germans, the Swiss, who had ate much higher levels of saturated fat, also had very low rates of heart disease. He also only sampled the diets of 3.9% of the population, which was not nearly a statistically representative sample. There's one little illustration of the problem that that shows how difficult the data was. He went on one of his three visits to the island of Crete when he was collecting dietary data. He went during Lent. On the Greek Orthodox Lent strictly prohibits the consumption of any animal foods, which would have meant that he obviously undercounted the amount of saturated fats that those islanders ate, something he discusses in his paper but doesn't really reckon with. So, you know, I think more than anything, the problem with the study was that it shows association, but not a cause and effect relationship, right? It's just an association. And, you know, many years later, the Seven Countries authors, not Ansel Keys, because I think he had passed away, but they published a reanalysis of the data showing that actually what correlated best with heart attack risk was the consumption of sweets. So basically sugar, right? Dessert, sweets. And they said, well, they had considered sweets, you know, that as something, or sugar as something that might cause heart disease, but that Ansel Keys was vehemently opposed to that idea. And that's why it never saw the light of day. So there was really weak evidence, but, you know, their official policy and the adoption of this hypothesis, Ansel Keys's hypothesis, by the National Institutes of Health, the American Heart Association, by all many major institutions, had already taken place. So what was set in motion is something we still see today, which is public health institutions completely devoted to an idea, even despite the fact that the science really has never proven it to be true.
It's extraordinary. So Ansel Keys' bias was writ large over this research that he performed. And as you said, there are many, many holes in the research. And I suppose the one that stands out to me really is that the research was performed on men. So it rules out half of the world's population immediately. So after that, then the narrative then became replace saturated fat with polyunsaturated fats from vegetable oils. And then so began the decline of Western health. Can you explain to me then what the response was then from the medical field and from the food industry? Because they love this. Well, certain elements of the food industry love this philosophy.
It's been 50 years of history now, 70 years of history if you go back to 1961, right? So initially, scientists said, we need to get some better data on Ansel Keys' hypothesis. And so they conducted proper randomized controlled clinical trials all over the world that do show cause and effect relationships, right? A more rigorous kind of data, gold standard data. Those trials were done on some 76,000 people all over the world. It's by far and away the most tested hypothesis in the field of nutrition is Ansel Keys' hypothesis. And every single one of those trials concluded that saturated fat and cholesterol have no effect on cardiovascular mortality or total mortality. And the vast majority of those trials also show no effect on any kind of cardiovascular events like heart attacks. So there's a little nuance in the data there, but I mean, really the overwhelming result is saturated fats is not driving this disease. What were the results of what happened to the results of those clinical trials? Well, they were basically ignored and suppressed, and they were, you know, most of them were not included in roundup review papers, and they were just sort of left to try to fade away. For decades, there's sort of a huge body of scientific literature that was lost. Then my book came along in 2014, and I pushed the whole issue to the surface again. I had unearthed those trials. My book is really focused on what have we got it wrong on saturated fats? What is all the data? What is all the history? And it tells a story of Ansel Keys and others. So 2014, that's 10 years ago, right? What happened? Well, researchers all over the world read my book or news articles that came from it. Or, I mean, there were actually, well, that's sort of the main story. There's some other people in the story who also helped bring this to light. But my book was the main driver, resulting in 23 review papers, most of them systematic reviews and meta-analyses, which is a very rigorous way of reviewing the evidence. And nearly all of those reviews say saturated fats, all these clinical trials, no effect on mortality, little or no effect on any kind of cardiovascular events like heart attacks. 23 papers. What happens? You would think, like, we're in the middle of it. We're having a paradigm shift. We should, you know, we're going to change unsaturated fats. New thinking, new scholarship. We got it wrong. But what happened was not that. What happened was that there has been, in the last decade that this scholarship has been going on, an effort by authorities, our health authorities, in the U.S., but also recently the World Health Organization and their new saturated fat guidelines, to basically deny all this data, to deny the data on mortality from the clinical trials, which is the most valuable data we have, and to pretend like these 23 review papers don't exist. That is, in short, what has happened on saturated fat, is that we have this huge resuppression of all the data all over again.
I might add that you wrote a very good paper at the end of 2022 entitled The Short History of Saturated Fat, The Making and Unmaking of a Scientific Consensus. And I will link that in the show notes for this episode. I suppose my question wanted to encapsulate the response from the medical community, but also I made reference to the food industry, because there's no secret, obviously, that the fact that the evidence was, well, was manipulated, as you say, but also, for example, big sugar companies, it suited them to say that fat was bad, saturated fat was bad, which meant then they could sell low-fat products with high sugar. And as you mentioned already, sugar is itself at the heart of this problem, certainly as far as Western health is concerned.
Yes. So the food industry has, since 1940, actually, the then emerging processed food industry, like the Standard Biscuit Company, formed a group to influence nutrition science. That was its goal. And so for the last 80 years, that's what it's been doing with tremendous success. There's virtually no nutrition scientist who does not receive money from the food industry. And, you know, so many different players are involved. I mean, one of the interesting things that I document in that paper is how, you know, we're told the big bad meat industry gets so much attention as the meat and dairy, really, as the bad guys. But let's just talk about, you know, who are the giant multinational players out there? That's Unilever, Nestle, Mondelez Foods. These are not like household names, some of them, but they, what do they produce? They produce packages and all that so-called ultra-processed junk food on supermarket shelves that is basically made up of three ingredients: grains, sugar, salt, four, vegetable oils, right? That's your cereal, your crackers, your cookies, your chips. All of that is made from those ingredients, notably no saturated fat, right? So those are the major shakers that are, you know, movers and shakers in the food industry, is the processed food industry. Then there's the sugar industry. There's a cute story that is not as significant as it's made out to be, but the sugar industry paid a Harvard scientist something like $20,000 in the 1950s to write something to leave off criticizing sugar and instead write about saturated fats as the probable boogeyman in provoking heart disease. But, you know, it's not just the sugar industry. Who else benefits? The vegetable oil industry. So ADM, Monsanto, Bunge, Unilever, some of the biggest, again, biggest companies in the world, huge multinational powerhouses. They make vegetable oils, and those are the oils like soybean, canola, sunflower, safflower, that were virtually not in the food supply at all and have risen now to be maybe 10% or more calories of all of our diets. They used to be, they were invented to be lubricants for the Industrial Revolution and used to lubricate machinery in the late 1800s. When we had hunted out all the whales, we needed oil for this large machinery. That's another story that I tell in my book about how they came into the food supply. And so what did the vegetable oil companies do? Well, they, in 1948, they became they kind of overnight transformed the American Heart Association into a powerhouse with what is in today's dollars, $20 million that they were able to sponsor a radio contest and make the American Heart Association the beneficiary. And they and then they presented the American Heart Association with a giant check. So this was the company Procter & Gamble that makes Crisco oil. And then some years later, there is the head of the American Heart Association posing in an ad with a bottle of Crisco oil, and the American Heart Association telling everybody to consume these oils instead of saturated fat to protect against heart disease. Procter & Gamble is still a supporter of the American Heart Association. These companies, these vegetable oil companies, are extremely influential. And actually, in part of my book, I write about something called the Institute for Shortening and Edible Oils, which is the trade association for the vegetable oil companies. And I spoke to scientists from those who worked for that group who were talking about how they would harass scientists at conferences. They were hired to do this to prevent any contrary science coming out about vegetable oils. You know, that we know much more about vegetable oils now, but I mean, for decades, any negative science about vegetable oils has been really hushed up. It's really complicated, all the different actors out there and their different interests, and they come from all directions. I mean, I guess the main point is just to say it's not just meat and dairy that's out there influencing policy. Every part of the food industry is influential and is lobbying in Washington.
I want to talk to you about the chapter in your book on how women and children are affected by a low-fat diet. Could you talk to me about this?
Well, as you said, the major nutrition studies were almost entirely on men. Women were not even studied until the late 1990s, even though they had been told to eat a low-fat diet for decades. And women are more compliant than men. They tend to be. They care more about being thin. And so it turned out when they finally did a huge clinical trial on women, some 49,000 women in the U.S. called the Women's Health Initiative, which was published in 2006 in a number of different papers, following the low-fat diet for an average of 7 years, did not benefit these women's health in any way. So no benefit for heart disease, diabetes. They lost maybe, you know, they were maybe 2 pounds lighter after 7 years than the control group, and no benefit for preventing any kind of cancer, which the trial had been powered for, which is unusual. So, and it turned out in other experiments, also funded by the U.S. government, that for women, when they lower their fat content, their risk of heart disease goes up. It goes up for everyone, but it goes up for women even more. That women are especially at risk of being on a low-fat diet, that it greatly increases their risk of heart attack, and that risk goes up the more that they lower the fat in their diet.
So, sorry, say that again. So if you reduce your consumption of saturated fat, your risk of heart attack goes up.
Yep. If you reduce your consumption of total fat, right, including saturated fat, and you reduce your dietary cholesterol, your risk of heart disease goes up. I mean, short explanation is you stop eating or you dramatically reduce the amount of animal foods you eat. And what do you put on your plate instead of the traditional Sunday roast that our grandparents had? You're having pasta. You're having other grains. You're getting less protein and far more starches, which, you know, generally speaking, carbohydrates. Carbohydrates, we now know, if you have them in high quantities, all of your lipid markers are, you know, which are the risk factors for heart disease, get worse. Almost every single one of them. So that's why restricting fat. This is true for everyone, but especially true for women. It was also true for women that women who have higher cholesterol live longer. This was found in the largest ever longitudinal study called the Framingham Study. When these results came out, they realized, oh, it's different for men than for women. For men, especially in middle age, higher cholesterol did seem to indicate or was linked to higher risk from heart attack. But that was never found for women. And again, the higher the cholesterol, the longer women were found to live. But our authorities they thought, oh, it's too complicated to give advice to men and women differently. And mostly men are getting heart attacks, so we'll just give advice to everyone based on the male data. And most women have no idea that a higher cholesterol is, total cholesterol, is likely to, it indicates that they might live longer.
Talk to me then about the presence then of the pharmaceutical industry in this conversation, because they benefit also from the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, the pharmaceutical, it's hard to be cynical enough about the pharmaceutical industry. They clearly benefit when people are sick. They don't benefit when people die. So for them, the perfect scenario is to have a chronic disease that takes place over a very long period of time, for which you have to take medication daily. Like insulin, like statins, like now these GLP-1 inhibitors for weight loss, a permanent prescription for medication. So chronic disease, that's their sweet spot. And when I first started researching in this field, I didn't understand why all these nutrition scientists were receiving money from pharmaceutical companies. I honestly couldn't understand it. And it took me a while to realize that these nutritionists were, I don't want to be too cynical about it, but their pharma money is focused on doing research on non-dietary solutions. Like, to give a very simple example, one member of the U.S. Expert Dietary Guideline Committee, probably the most influential committee in the world, he got millions of dollars from Optifast, right? Which is owned by, I can't remember what, Nestle or something. But some of those are owned by pharmaceutical companies. A non-diet solution for obesity, right? It's not about food. Another example is nutrition scientists doing research on supplements. Another non-food solution to disease. So that takes their eye off the food solution, the idea that diet alone can, which it can, reverse chronic diseases. The other thing to say about the pharmaceutical companies is that they are very clever about funding scientists who then get on guideline committees. I mean, this is a little bit of a story, but I'm going to explain it to you. When we're told to lower our LDL cholesterol, our so-called bad cholesterol, and then we're told to lower it, you know, the guidelines, they used to be your LDL below 150 was fine. Then it went down to 130. Then it went down to 100. Each of those lowerings requires pulling together a committee of scientists. And the pharmaceutical industry funds, when I went in to look at one of these committees, every single one of them was funded by the pharmaceutical companies. Why does that affect
our decisions about food? Well, lowering LDL cholesterol is something that you can do with drugs, but you're also told to do it with your diet by switching out saturated fat for polyunsaturated vegetable oils. A major reason we're told to do that is to lower our, LDL cholesterol. So bringing down those guidelines has a huge impact on the food industry. The other influence the pharmaceutical companies have is they all give money to the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association. So for instance, the American Diabetes Association does not tell people that they can reverse their diabetes by greatly reducing their carbohydrate content. Giving $1 million apiece yearly to the American Diabetes Association in their elite donor circle is every single insulin manufacturer. So that association, supposed to be in the interest of the public health, telling people how they can best combat diabetes, is giving people now misinformation about diet, telling them to consume carbohydrates at every meal, the one macronutrient that they cannot tolerate. And that is almost surely informed by who their funders are, which are the pharmaceutical companies, the insulin manufacturers.
Why isn't this making headline news every day on our TVs and on the internet? Because when I think back 3-4 years ago, the furore at the time about vaccines, for example, I know it's a separate issue, but everybody was really scrutinizing these vaccines. And yet people are consuming foods, man-made foods very often, based on these dietary recommendations that are being influenced by these vested interests that you're talking about. So why isn't there more noise? Why hasn't there been more furore about this in the Western world and especially America?
Well, I mean, if you take the vaccine issue as an example, where we saw very little conversation, debate about the vaccines, about the lockdowns, about any of our COVID policies, I mean, you could say the food and pharmaceutical industries have been operating in the same way for decades longer when it comes to information about dietary fat, cholesterol, carbohydrates, what is a healthy diet, and what is a diet that will make you sick. There is a virtual shutdown on that information, and over the last 10 years, it's gotten vastly worse. Whereas a decade ago, I could have published something in the New York Times or a number of other mainstream newspapers or gone on TV. That is much harder now. And I think that you have to assume that due to their advertising, which comes of the lion's share of the advertising, especially in television, comes from pharmaceutical companies. This is done not to necessarily promote their products, but to control what that media reports on. Through the veiled threat that they'll pull their funding if they go off script. I mean, there's actually a really good example of this where I did a story on trans fats, which is considered a very bad byproduct of hardening vegetable oils. I did this story in the early 2000s that came out in a magazine called Gourmet. It was really a blockbuster story that brought a lot. It really kind of broke the story on trans fats, and it included a lot of salacious stories about these scientists who had harassed other scientists for doing early research on trans fats. The editor-in-chief of my magazine, she almost didn't publish this story because Procter & Gamble, again, maker of Crisco oil, threatened to pull their advertising from the magazine, and that would have been a truly significant loss for them. But she says, she held the line on that. And she said in her memoir, that was one of the decisions of which she was the most proud. That's a tiny example of what has to be happening on a massive scale with our media.
And writing this book, you had difficulty getting scientists to talk to you. Could you speak to me about that and why they didn't want to talk to you? Because it comes back to funding again.
Well, when I was starting on my research in the early 2000s, and at that time, nobody even challenged the low-fat diet, which now has undergone a real change in even in official dietary advice. But at that time, people said, I can't talk to you about the low-fat diet, or I can't talk to you about that study. Or these are university scientists I was speaking to who couldn't speak, or I got hung up on because they were too afraid to discuss, say, those contrary results from the Women's Health Initiative. They just, many scientists live in real fear of getting on the wrong side of the nutritional status quo or the dogma of their field, right? It's not that they're overly fearful people, but what happens to them? And these are also stories I document in my book. They lose their nutrition. They lose their grant funding. They can't even do science. They're disinvited or not invited to conferences. They can't get their studies published. The primary opponent to Ansel Keys in his day was, or one of them, was a University of Vanderbilt scientist named George Mann, who was vocally opposed to Ansel Keys. And he told me a story where he was at the NIH National Institutes of Health, and a secretary pulled him out into the hall and said, if you continue your opposition to Ansel Keys, you're going to lose your research grant. And he did. I have co-authored papers over the last 10 years with some of the most prominent scientists in the field of nutrition, but they're all people at the end of their careers. They're all on the verge of retirement. Younger scientists say, I can't risk it. I'll get kicked out of this or that committee. So, I mean, there are real punishments. I mean, I did a cover story for the BMJ, a very respected journal, a cover story on the lack of science in the U.S. dietary guidelines. That became the subject of a retraction effort that is the largest in the history, in our recent history, with almost 180 people signing on to a letter asking them to retract this paper. Not because it was flawed, not because any of its assertions were untrue or undocumented, but they couldn't stand for that to exist in the peer-reviewed published literature. And the editor stood by that article and wrote in its defense, but that was after a year-long review. It was very political, very unpleasant. But that shows you the level of harassment, I mean, bullying. It's academic bullying, and I'm not the only person by a long shot to have suffered it.
No, I think you've been you've been very brave, certainly, without a shadow of a doubt, because you're putting yourself out there and you're putting your career on the line every time you put your pen to paper. I'm interested to find your opinion. This is a slightly left field, but kind of connected to what we're talking about here. I've asked various medical experts in recent weeks in interviews what their thoughts are on these new weight loss drugs like Ozempic. What's your opinion on the whole area of weight loss drugs?
Well, I mean, unsurprisingly, I'm not a fan because I know the scientific literature on that it is completely possible to reverse diet-related diseases with diet alone. That gets to the root cause of the problem, and it gives you a healthy diet, which will sustain you and make help you avoid disease and live long. Also, I'm not a fan of a lifelong dependence on a medication for which we truly do not know the long-term consequences. I mean, it's one thing for Oprah, who recently had a big, huge TV special on ABC, by the way, heavily funded by pharmaceutical companies. It's one thing for a 70-year-old woman to go on a weight loss drug. If it shaves off a few years of her life, I'm sad about that. But it's very different than putting 12-year-olds, as they are now doing, on these medications for their entire lives, where we really don't know the long-term consequences. The short-term consequences are it slows down your gastric, your whole digestive system, and it can lead to stomach paralysis, not unknown. There's a long list of other potential side effects. I mean, it really worries me, and it completely shifts the conversation away from diet, which is the only, if diet is causing our diet-related diseases, it is diet that you need to use to reverse them. as hard as that may seem, it is possible. And just to like give a little hope in your listeners' heads when they're thinking, there's no way I can do that. In multiple clinical trials, they've shown people can reverse their type 2 diabetes. These are people with like 8 years on average of having type 2 diabetes. They reverse it in 10 weeks. Half of the study population had reversed their type 2 diabetes and sustained it over years. In every head-to-head trial, a low-fat versus a low-carbohydrate diet, people lose more weight on a low-carbohydrate diet. And on those diets, of 23 cardiovascular risk factors measured, 22 of them improve going on a low-carbohydrate diet. So it's certainly possible, and it's much more of a long-term, viable, sustainable, risk-free strategy for reversing these diseases.
I'm glad you mentioned Oprah, because when I saw that she had decided to go on this new weight loss drug, Ozempic, I was actually disappointed, because I remember about 30 years ago at this stage on her Oprah TV talk show, I remember her wheeling out a trolley with, I think, 80 pounds of fat. That was equivalent to the weight that she had lost. And she's become, I think, a weight loss icon for people. I know she was involved with the Weight Watchers for a long period of time as well. So I suppose my question is, were you disappointed to see that she had gone down this route now after all of those years trying all the other different ways to lose weight? Because she's really a figurehead for many people who have been trying to lose weight all down through those years.
Well, I mean, she her program was like an infomercial. I think in turn it had reps from the pharmaceutical companies on it. And I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's terrible to live with the burden of obesity, and I truly sympathize with people who've had to do it. Oprah has made a ton of money off of her investment in Weight Watchers. She makes money off of going up the scale and going down the scale. And I mostly just lament that nobody has ever told her, obviously, about a ketogenic diet. That would be a much better, I think for the most part, people really just don't know about the real solutions. People are desperate to lose weight. They don't know that there is a sustainable, easy way to a way to lose weight that's sustainable with diet. And so they jump on the fat wagon, as she did years ago, by starving herself with Optifast shakes, or they jump on the weight loss drugs. But I feel incredibly sad that most people are not getting good information, including probably even Oprah. They're just not getting information about the options available to them.
Well, that brings me very nicely then to a lovely observation that you made elsewhere about how doctors today aren't getting the right information. They're not being taught to see illness as a symptom of systemic disease, and instead are compartmentalizing the body and treating a headache without looking at systemic causes. So could you talk to me about your philosophy on this?
It's the same. I mean, our doctors, I don't know about in the UK, in the US, out of their years of medical training, they might have a single day or half a day on nutrition, and then they're taught the incorrect dietary advice that comes from our national guidelines. Your guidelines are the same in the UK. High carbohydrate diets, lower in fat, minimize animal foods. That is a diet that will worsen health. No question about it. So that's what they're taught, and that's what they teach to their patients in good faith. And then when their patients don't get better, what can they do? They can only prescribe a pill or a device or to their ever worsening patients. A doctor friend of mine said she was, I think it's one of the reasons for doctor burnout. She said, she would come home every day from her clinic and put her head down and say to her family, I am like a legal drug dealer. But it's truly not the fault of most doctors. That's what they're taught in medical school. The medical school curricula have been developed with the help of the pharmaceutical companies. I have another story from a friend in medical school who was getting taught whatever small little time they had to focus on nutrition, and they were being taught the government's guidelines. After class, this person goes up to the teacher and says, "Hey, you've heard about carbohydrate restriction as a viable way to lose weight." And the doctor said, "Well, I'm on a ketogenic diet myself, but I'm not allowed to teach it." So, you know, I also see doctors of being victims of the system. And in the U.S., it's almost impossible to break out.
Well, let's talk about healthy diets. And I would like to get your opinion on what is probably deemed to be across the world the gold standard of diet that we should all ascribe to, and that is the Mediterranean diet. What are your thoughts here?
Well, actually, I have a chapter on that in my book that is really the only real critique of the Mediterranean diet out there, and it tells the fun, fantastic story of how the Mediterranean diet was started. Fabulous conferences for scientists and chefs all over the Mediterranean, this wonderful kind of luxury vacation, scientific conferences, all about the, you know, eating fruits and vegetables in the Mediterranean, and all, it turns out, funded by principally the International Olive Oil Council, which was trying to promote olive oil to Americans to increase their consumption, to open up markets, and also other food industries that were benefiting from this idea of the Mediterranean diet. It was a commercial concept from the start, hugely successful. And as I talk about in my book about how the real Mediterranean diet, first of all, varies enormously by country. It varies from North Italy to South Italy. I mean, the amounts and types of foods and meat and types of fats that they consume really varies tremendously. So there is no one Mediterranean diet. And the other huge misconception is it's not low in meat. Anybody who's been on vacation in the Mediterranean knows that those are not vegan-leaning menus. And that was true historically, that, you know, that there was, just to give you an example, like what they would eat goat and lamb. And when researchers would go and ask, this was also true of the Blue Zones, the famous Blue Zones, when researchers go and ask people about what they eat, since we don't eat goat and lamb, definitely not goat, in the U.S., they didn't even ask them about their consumption. They never recorded it. So, I mean, there's so many problems with the data on the Mediterranean diet. And, you know, certainly there are true believers in that diet, such as the Harvard researchers who launched it as an official concept in the early 1990s. But you know, some of that data that they used to start the Mediterranean diet actually came from Ansel Keys's study on Crete with the Lent data. Confounding. So, I mean, it's a really interesting story, but ultimately, when they test the Mediterranean diet, what are its benefits? No ability to prevent diabetes, or certainly not the ability to reverse diabetes. Very little effect on weight loss. Marginal, not the best diet for weight loss. For cardiovascular disease, which it's been touted for, the effects that were seen in the large Spanish trial called PREDIMED, they showed a benefit for stroke. They did not show much of a benefit for any other events, for heart attacks or any other cardiovascular events. That diet was 40% fat in Spain. It was not a low-fat diet. And the people in the Mediterranean diet did not reduce their red meat consumption. So what they tested in that trial that seemed to show benefits, limited benefits, was not what we think of as a Mediterranean diet, which is, you know, low in red meat, mostly fruits and vegetables. That's not what was tested in that experiment.
Okay, so for the audience then, they're probably thinking to themselves, everything I know that is wrong up until now. So in your experience, given all the research and all the papers you've trawled through and the books you've written and the people you've spoken to, what, in your opinion, would a good, healthy diet look like? I think you mentioned the ketogenic diet earlier. It's obviously going to be high in meat products and in fat, but could you give us a more detailed look at what you think it would look like?
Yes. It doesn't have to be. You know, ketogenic is very low carbohydrate. So first of all, if you're a healthy person, you have a more range of what you can eat. That means no metabolic diseases. So if you're somebody with diabetes, cardiovascular disease, overweight or obesity, blah, 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 those diseases, you have to restrict yourself further. If you have one of those metabolic diseases, you are largely intolerant to carbohydrates, which is sugar and starches. So you can't eat as much of those. It seems unfair, I know. And we all know about the Japanese who ate a lot of rice, but and who seem to be healthy. But once you tip over into ill health, you are like a person with allergies. You cannot, you no longer have a tolerance that you once had to all these grains and sugars that you eat. Us unhealthy people have to eat different things. Okay, so what does that look like? It's mainly animal foods, your diet, if you can do it. It's, you know, fish, chicken, red meat. Do not be afraid of red meat. It's incredibly nutrient dense, actually, far more so than chicken. Shellfish, any kind of dairy, if you can tolerate it, especially cheese, I think is a little easier for people to digest and full fat, everything. Don't go low fat. That should be really at the top of your, well, if we do an up, that should be the bottom of your pyramid. The big slab should be those foods. And then as you head up, you get to non-starchy vegetables, green vegetables that are anything that grows underground, such as turnips and potatoes, onions, those are starchy, more starchy. So above the non-starchy green vegetables, you have starchy vegetables, and you can put in low-sugar fruits. Like some fruits are intensely concentrated in sugar, like pineapple, mango, lots of sugar. Berries, not so much. So then as you go up your pyramid, you get to the sugary fruits and grains. Grains, you know, starches are just sugar molecules holding hands, and the moment you eat them, they become sugar. So you get grains, sugary fruits, sugar, candy up there at the tip top. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. But I love the way you phrase that, starches, sugar molecules holding hands. I love that. I've never heard that before. Speaking of which, my second last question for you is this. You established the Nutrition Coalition. Could you tell me what is its mission?
That's a nonprofit group I established in 2015, right after my book came out. And the idea was we could change the dietary guidelines, which, you know, if they could just respond to the science. We did a lot. It's no longer operating in full force today, but we did a lot. We got Congress to recognize the problem. We got Congress to spend $2 million for four reports from the National Academy of Sciences, which is the, you know, top authority on science that the government relies upon. Those reports came out saying the methodology of the dietary guidelines is flawed. It's not rigorous. It needs updating. We can't rely on guidelines that come out of this methodology. It was all about the methodology, the process, the scientific process, because our group never advocated for any specific diet. We were really just advocating for a more rigorous process, like do good science. So those National Academy of Sciences reports are a big deal. But what happened, the USDA, which is our government agency in responsible for our dietary guidelines, basically ignored all those recommendations. I mean, they didn't implement them. We are the group, the watchdog group that made all that happen, that recorded, you know, we really stayed on top of what the dietary guidelines was doing. But ultimately, there's, you know, we're a tiny little group, mostly grassroots funding. We're up against huge amounts of money going into all of our government agencies from the food and pharmaceutical industries. Ultimately, we found that we could not make significant headway against the huge lineup of the food industry influences over our government guidelines. And so we've largely retreated, and I'm now focusing much, much more on my journalism.
And I suppose my final question then is, can we be hopeful for the future given the resistance that you've met down through the years and very much so over the last 10 years, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, all of those vested interests with huge amounts of money and the lack of willingness on the part of the government there in America and other Western governments to look into that relationship that the pharmaceutical industry has with the food industry, and that the relationship that they both have then with the organizations like the American Heart Association?
Look, what can we as little people on this planet do? I mean, one thing you can do is get yourself and your loved ones healthy, right? Read up and, you know, find your favorite carnivore or low-carb influencer and become a healthier person. And the people make... And try to get the people around you healthy. It's not easy. And so that's the first thing to do. Then you can start to try to contribute to groups or influence your local practitioner or you know, be an advocate in some way. Obviously, it depends on where you live and what country. And then you can support journalists like me. I mean, sign up for my Unsettled Science newsletter on Substack, or buy my book, or do something, you know, support the journalists. I mean, it's really been journalists who have brought this issue to the fore. Myself, a few other journalists, there's not many of us. And it's really important to support us because nutrition scientists themselves are unable to referee their own profession, as I described. So, I mean, just trying to be active in any way in your environment where you can be, I think, you know, I see a real burgeoning grassroots movement in this area. And I think we just all have to contribute in the ways that we can.
It's an astonishing story outlined in the book. The book, again, is called The Big Fat Surprise. Nina Teicholz, author of the book. Thank you so much for joining me today. Really enjoyed our chat.
Thank you for having me on. I've enjoyed it too.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you liked it and any of the previous episodes, show your support. You can like, subscribe, and share with other people who you think might enjoy these episodes, and leave a comment on YouTube and leave us a positive rating on iTunes and on Spotify. Until next time, stay happy.